The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
You have to understand and manage yourself before you can lead other people. Both of those are hard, but managing yourself is harder. But if you start with understanding yourself, then you know which parts you want to manage.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Margaret Andrews. Margaret's got some very cool titles. So a Harvard instructor, an author of Manage Yourself to Lead Others, and the director and founder of the Milo Center. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about how you came to be doing the work, how you came to write the book. Where your energy is being channeled right now?
That's always a good question. I'm also a big energy person too. I always think where your energy goes is where you should really follow.
Yeah.
As well. So the Milo book, Manage Yourself to Lead Others, is actually an outgrowth of stuff I've been doing for close to 20 years. I created a class called Managing Yourself and Leading Others at Harvard almost 20 years ago. And it's had a wait list every time it's been offered. So we created a two-day executive program. You know, we stripped out a lot of the reading and the papers and that kind of thing and created a two-day executive program. And it's become the most popular professional program at Harvard. I've done a speech with it, which resonates with a lot of different audiences. And so it seemed like, well, you know, what's the next step? If you want to take it to a wider circle, it's a book. So that's how it came about.
Brilliant. And how did you find that topic, that course in the first place? What led you to that inspiration?
Oh, yeah. My own bad management. I think that a lot of people that either research or write about a topic are doing it because they need it too. You know, so I had my own experience where I kind of came to find that I was not the leader that I thought I was, and I was definitely not the leader I wanted to be. And so that just set me on a path to say, I do not like this. I want to change it. And so, you know, I did a lot of research, and by looking at academic studies and management books and famous people and people I knew and you know, philosophy and psychology and sociology and all of these kinds of things. And that's where I thought, you know, I did it really, truly to fix myself. And it worked pretty well. And so yeah. I started talking about it to people, and people said, you know, you should create a class about that. And that's kind of how the whole thing started.
Brilliant. And I'm intrigued, as I think about teams and teamwork, how often it does start with self, because the teamwork part's really hard. Mm-hmm. And you need to, I've been following a lot of Stoic philosophy recently, mm-hmm. and you need to be really aware of how you're experiencing something and how you're going to respond to that in order to bring out the best of team members, I find, in work. Yes. We had a guest on the show the other day, Tony Thielen, and he shared a great quote that said, like, when an event happens, it's your response to that event that creates the experience. And so I'm working heavily on, like, my own responses to things, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Before I know how to kind of bring the team up into whatever work we're going to set out in pursuit of.
Absolutely. I'm a fan of Stoic philosophy too. And, you know, the whole idea of the book and the class and everything is that you have to understand and manage yourself before you can lead other people. And, you know, this goes back a long time ago. You know, as you probably read, that know yourself was carved into the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. And, you know, Lao Tzu very famously said, you know, to understand others is intelligence, to understand yourself is true wisdom, to master others is strength, to master yourself is true power, right? It's all of these kinds of things, right? So these are not new concepts, but they're hard.
Yeah. I'm glad you called out hard, because I think there's a lot of conversation right now about soft skills and hard skills and the rest of it. But, you know, the work, the self-work, and then the teamwork is always hard, because it's always dynamic. And there are Yes. so many pieces at play that it's never going to be easy. And I don't think you ever truly master it. You're always kind of coming back to your frameworks, mindsets, anchoring techniques, whatever it might be.
I think that is absolutely true. And I love that you said dynamic, because I think we understand, intuitively that teams are dynamic. But what we oftentimes don't think about is that we are dynamic too. We are not just one person. We don't show up the same all day or every day, right? We change. We get in an argument with somebody and it changes our mood, or we get some good news and it changes our mood. So yes, we ourselves are dynamic.
Before we dive into the book, that actually reminds me of some of this, I think it's called internal family systems. It's like the parts. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of that one, Margaret.
I have, yeah.
Yeah. So I've been doing a lot of that work with Riker, my 14-year-old lately. And mm-hmm. so when something bad will happen, like he'll have a bad score on a test and he'll be coming in under this dark storm cloud as we come home at the end of the day or we go to rugby training. And so we've been doing a lot of this work, like a part of me is feeling really angry that I screwed up that test. But a part of me is also really excited I get to hang out with my baby sister or go to practice. And I'm finding that kind of parts breakdown is a very simple and helpful way to kind of activate and be aware of like what's going on for me and what do I want next.
Yes.
So that's been super powerful as a parent.
Oh, and so helpful for your kids too. Yeah. To learn this stuff early, this really should be part of their curriculum.
Yeah, definitely. So another thing that catches me about your book before we get into real detail is you've got manage and lead in the title. And there's a lot of conversation around there around managers do this and leaders do that. Like how much of that was intentional and how much do you see the separate duties of managing self and leading others?
You know, I don't make a distinction, really. I don't really think so much about that. I mean, in the sense that I think more than you are a manager versus you are a leader, I don't really draw that distinction for so many reasons. You know, one is I've heard all kinds of things like, you know, managers do things right and leaders do the right thing. And I think that's silly, right? And I just think that it's really more about what the situation needs. And also, I've heard some people say that you manage processes and you lead people. So, you know, and then I always say, well, where would the dividing line be between these two things? You know, I think it's in some ways it's almost like a silly argument. I also don't know how many angels fit on the head of a pin, but I don't worry about that much either.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's an important point to raise, which is that a lot of people do try and attach a very simple heuristic or otherwise to what is a hard and complex thing, going back to our earlier point.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that, and also I believe that leadership is very contextual, that you have to be prepared. And one of the very best ways to prepare for almost any job in leadership is to understand and manage yourself, because then at least you are stable.
Yes. I actually was working with a friend who's attached to Jobs for the Future the other day, and they're really actively trying to create economic mobility for people earning less than $60,000 a year. And I'm intrigued, particularly with your experience, both consulting, teaching, and being around education at large, how much you see the skills and practices that we develop in our learning stages of life, let's call it 13 to 24, where we've come out of childhood, we're learning how to exist in the world. It feels like a lot of the people that tend to get opportunities to break through that ceiling are the ones who learnt more about managing themselves through education or through a particular job or a mentor or something along the way, because that tends to separate people out when everyone's going to have a rough moment. And if you can have a rough moment, manage yourself well, and still show up for the company, the customer, the team, you can continue to kind of grow and learn. But if you have a really rough moment and you have a meltdown, you throw your apron down and you walk out of the kitchen or whatever you do, those traumas can actually become a little bit self-fulfilling. And then you kind of, a ceiling starts to show up because you're not managing yourself well, and then other people aren't taking you forwards in your growth.
That's right. That you're spot on. And so many and it's not just there. It's truly everywhere.
It's everywhere. Yeah.
In fact, I just earlier today was over at MIT and I was running a session with folks from they were all assistant and associate deans. And so we did this exercise around their best boss and, you know, what makes a best boss and things like that. And it turns out that, you know, there's kind of these three buckets. One is intelligence or IQ. Second one is technical and functional skills. And the third one is interpersonal skills or, you know, relationship skills, soft skills, EI, whatever you want to call it. And so when we did this exercise, I would say probably close to 90% of the reasons why somebody was their best boss, this is across everybody that was in the room, were on those interpersonal skills. And somebody raised their hand and they asked a great question. They said, I wonder if this would be different if you did it with faculty, right? Would IQ be a lot more important? And I said, well, funny you should ask, because about a month or so ago, I did this exact same exercise with science faculty at Harvard. And I said, their results were even more skewed than yours, right?
Really?
Yes. So, but that gets to your point, right? Is that it turns out that IQ is very, very helpful to you when you're in school. And also early in your career as you're learning all these new things. And by the way, for the rest of your life, and our, you know, technical and functional skills, because those are super important when you're early in your career. If you can't, you know, balance a balance sheet, you're not going to be promoted. But what happens is that the more that our work is done with and through other people, the more the interpersonal skills take center stage. Because at some point you're not doing the work yourself, right? So it doesn't matter if you're the best accountant or the best engineer or data scientist or whatever it is. What matters is that you can work with other people. And that's exactly what you're explaining. If we are very reactive all the time, people learn to back away from us. And if they have a new opportunity, we are not going to be the first person they ask, right? It's going to be somebody else.
Which in such changing times, new technology, new markets opening up, globalization, you name it, I think more leaders need to be able to bring out the best ideas, insights, capabilities of their teams than ever before. You can't set a 5-year strategy and not that I think you ever could, but it's not as linear as it once was.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true. I think it's bold to even think of a 3-year strategy sometimes.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, neat. So jumping into the book, you know, for someone who is out there thinking this is something I need, I've had some bad management experiences, I'm excited to be part of a higher performing team or to go out and achieve something very differently in this next chapter, what will they be expecting? What will they encounter as they come into your work?
Oh, yeah. So I think if you mean in the book in particular, there's a lot of exercises, a lot of particular reflective exercises, different ways to get at understanding yourself, and then different tools and techniques to manage yourself.
Nice.
And also to understand other people and to manage other people, including, you know, people that work directly for you, your boss, and people that don't work in your hierarchy. So a lot of team members or, you know, just people on your level. So there's a lot of frameworks, a lot of exercises, a lot of stories and anecdotes too about people that did it well, people that didn't do it well. And as I always say, people that hit the wall and said, wow, that hurt. I don't want to do that again. So they finally at some point kind of say, whoa, that hurt. I want to try something different now. And so they're ready for it.
It's amazing as humans how well we can learn through the painful mistakes of others.
Yes. Because there's oftentimes part of us that recognizes, you know what, that's me too.
Yeah,
or I have some tinge of that as well. And I think one of the most interesting things that ever happened in the classroom, and it was certainly one of the most courageous things I've ever heard in a classroom, was one time when we were discussing this case in an executive program, and it was about, you know, Dr. Ron Ventura, a brilliant, brilliant surgeon who performs his job flawlessly. However, he has another side, which is he's a bully and he yells at people and intimidates them, etc. And so in this case discussion, we're taking the position of his boss, a hospital administrator, and we're trying to figure out, you know, what do we do with this guy? You know, he's so awesome. We should keep him and coach him. On the other hand, it's like, no, my goodness, this guy is, you know, running roughshod over everybody. And so it's a super impassioned discussion. And as we're finally, you know, kind of shutting down the discussion, I noticed this hand raised in the back of the room. And it's James, and it's the first time he's raised his hand the whole 2 days we've been together. And so I call on him, of course, and he says from the back of the room, he says, "I'm Dr. Ventura." And the whole room turned around at the same time and like, oh my gosh. And then, of course, he realizes what he just said and he kind of laughs and says, "Oh, I'm not the real Dr. Ventura." He said, "I'm an engineer, not a surgeon." But he said, "Pretty much everything else that's written about that could have been written about me." He said, "I'm a really, really good engineer, but I've been a horrible teammate and a really bad manager. And yeah, that's why I'm here. I was passed over for a promotion. And if I don't fix this, I'll probably get fired." And what was super interesting, A, that he had the courage to say
huge.
That. But B, was at the break, everybody wanted to talk to James. And it made me realize just how many people are harboring fears that they're James too.
Oh, yeah. In some small way, maybe not quite the full extent of mm-hmm. being a bully, but they feel it for sure. Fear is a really interesting one, Margaret, because I'm seeing it more and more. I think we all are seeing it more and more in daily life. You know, we've got this anxious generation. When you look at the data, we've got, forget the anxious generation, like everyone is experiencing anxiety at a much higher level than I think has been the case in some time. I think we've had 5 of the highest spikes in the last 30 or 40 years have happened in the last 5. So they're right
that.
On top of each other.
Yeah.
And when anxiety is upon us and that we're in that fear mindset, we tend to get really stuck. We kind of go to the concrete, we go to safety, and we're not really thinking about opening up to what mm-hmm. may be out there and what may be possible. I know pre-show you talked about this desire that people want to work together more effectively. Do you think that those two things might be related, that people are recognizing that fear and therefore wanting, desiring to be in teams that are more effective because they're carrying that burden daily?
I think that's part of it. I think the fear is there. I actually think sometimes the fear drives us towards wanting a sense of community, and that can be at work or outside, right? I think that there is a real desire for community. But I do think that, you know, what gives me hope about more teams performing more effectively is that I think there's a pretty strong desire for people to have better teams and better team experiences. Because, you know, if you've ever been on a really horrid team, you do not want to do that again. It hurts. It's very painful.
Yes.
And it brings out the worst in everyone, right? So we're just imagine a whole group of people all at their worst. It's pretty ugly. Whereas if you've ever been on a really, really high performing team, which I've been on one, it is a peak experience in your life. And
yeah,
you would spend the rest of your life trying to find another one just like that. So yeah, I think there's a desire.
I like that. I like the more positive framing of it. It is interesting, though, because I know Daniel Kahneman was on Adam Grant's show some time back, and he was talking about the one thing that is more objective and more identifiable in the workplace or in community at large is like misery. And maybe we should be focusing on reducing the misery. So when you talk about like, hey, when you're on a bad team, it brings out the worst in everyone. I wonder whether it's actually easier to start focusing on the positive that we want to build, the future we want to experience, versus, you know, putting out all the fires that may exist in that challenge team.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say, because I think every team is different. And I can't remember what writer said that what is it? Happy families are happy in the same way, but unhappy families are happy in individual ways or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that that's kind of true with teams, is that, you know, I oftentimes run an exercise with folks where I say, you know, okay, everybody, you know, just this is on your own, 5 minutes. Think of the worst team you were on and the best team you were on. And on each of those teams, think of why. What was going on that made it your best team or your worst team or whatever. Then I have them get together, you know, with two or three other people and kind of share their lists. And it turns out they have pretty much the same list. And
what do they see?
On the bad teams, it was that there were, you know, hidden agendas. People were not communicating. There was just kind of bad behavior, you know, people venting. They were not telling the truth, is what I want to say, about what's going on, how they're feeling, etc. Whereas the best teams, there was a sense of giving people the benefit of the doubt, having real conversations. A lot of times people talk about holding people accountable, but what I found is that when people talk about that on a good team, what they mean is they have real conversations that they say, hey, so-and-so, you know, your part of this project isn't on time or, you know, wasn't up to standards or something like that. Let's talk about it. What's going on? And so they're acknowledging it and they're having a discussion about it. And that's so that everybody on the team knows what's going on. And also, if somebody is behind on something or not going well, there's lots of reasons, right? They're feeling sick or, you know, something's going on at home and other people, if they know, they can usually help or, you know, there's just lots of ways to solve a problem. But by hiding the problem, that's usually not one of them.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. Our research would suggest that identifying and defining the problem is one of the single most important things to do for a leader, because you can then set the team to work on the right thing rather than everyone chasing their own versions of truth or problem or whatever it might be. And so I am sensing right now, particularly in times when you're bringing teams together more dynamically, you know, it's not just the intact team. It's, hey, this team is, you know, multifunctional and responsible for launching this new market campaign or whatever it is, that you really have to start with that clarity around the problem, what we're trying to solve or achieve first.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And you can have a debate about that, but you got to come up with one. But the other thing I look at it is, you know, answering the question of what does success look like, right? Like paint the picture sort of thing. But I think another part of that is oftentimes not talked about is to say, you know, in achieving some goal, there's usually multiple goals, but there's main goals and sub goals. And it's also identifying what is the main goal and therefore what are we deprioritizing or trading off, because you can't usually hit all of them. So which one is important?
Yeah, that is huge. I think a study I saw the other day said 50 to 100 projects being launched by digital transformation teams every year in large companies. It's hard for the team to know what is important in those environments. It's kind of raining on them, the change.
Yes, and we all get wet.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that, wow, that's a lot. That's you just can't do everything. You got to prioritize it and also have a path. You know, like, why are we doing this project number 17? And how does that relate to the past 16? Or does it not? Right?
Yeah.
So just being super clear about that.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And these real conversations in the book or in your, you know, other work, Margaret, how do you help leaders to have real conversations? Because it doesn't come naturally in my experience.
It doesn't always, yes. I think there's just a huge fear around these things. So I hit that in the when I talk about feedback, right? It's the same difficult conversation if it's a teammate or it's somebody that reports to you. And the thing is, I say it's actually our job. If we're the leader of that team, it is our job to help people get better. And so just recognizing that, one, takes, you know, I don't know, maybe it adds to the pressure because now you can't not do it. But the other is to think about, I go back to that best boss exercise that I do in the early parts of the book, because it really lays the groundwork, is that, you know, what we already know what good leadership looks like. Most of us have had at least one pretty good boss in our whole life. And it turns out that some of the biggest reasons why they were our best boss, or things like they trusted us. They gave us a lot of autonomy in how we did our work. They listened well, not just listened, but they heard what we were saying. Also that they challenged us and gave us support in terms of how to get there. And wasn't too far down the list is also that they kind of cared about us as individuals and not just widgets. And so, you know, if you take that, right, these are some of the biggest things that came out of the best boss is, and we apply that to people that we work with, whether they report to us directly or they're, you know, sort of our peers on a team or something like that. It starts to say, okay, we can have challenging conversations if it's aimed at making us better. You know, even our best boss gave us feedback, and we may not have liked that feedback, but they were doing it in the spirit of helping us get better. And that is why we're better. Somebody told us we can't get better at something if no one
without tells us. Without that review of progress. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
As you think about that, and I love that you pulled up care, there's been a lot of conversations, some good books coming out around mattering recently. Mm. And I like Zach Mercurio's framing of like, if you feel that you matter, you work like it matters. Like it's, I'm paraphrasing there.
I think that's true. If we think back to people that we worked with or for in our lives, the people that we felt like we mattered to them or our work mattered, we cared more, right? We absolutely cared more. And you're willing to kind of go the extra mile or to put a little bit of extra thought into it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So do you see that using feedback in some of those, you know, positive ways, tying it to the what does success look like and showing where that person's work contributes to that success? Do you think that it all kind of, it flows, it connects, there's part of the method there?
Yeah, I think it can, right? I'll emphasize can, doesn't always, right? And it, because I think it, there's so many factors that go into it. But yes, it can. And I think it is important to let people know why they're doing the work they're doing. It's so interesting that, you know, I also teach this class called Strategic Leadership, and it's for, you know, more senior level executives. And very oftentimes what kind of comes out there is people talking about, the different generations in the workforce. And, you know, everybody's kind of pointing fingers at, you know, other generations. And so I kind of let people go on about it for a little while. And I said, do you think this is new? You know, and they're like, well, you know, this is just a very different generation. I'm like, yeah. And so then I flash up a slide of Aristotle saying, you know, this new generation is, you know, lazy, etc. One of Socrates and one of Plato, all saying the same thing, right? And I said, no, this is always true. It used to be, you know, not all that long ago, it was the millennials that people were talking about, right?
Yeah.
And now it's the Z.
And that'll be alpha soon.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, but the thing is that we're all individuals and, you know, I don't, you know, I'm a native of California, but not all natives of California are the same. And, right? So I think we have to treat people as the individuals that they are and not some member of a certain group or something like that, right? We all have, you know, just because not all blondes are the same, not all accountants are the same, you know, all of those kinds of things that we all have our individuality and that's kind of what makes us who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. On that point, I've been playing with some AI lately. An AI attached to individual profiles and assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm intrigued by that because it allows me to not try and give someone generic feedback. Mm-hmm. I need you to be doing more of this. It allows me to go in and say, hey, I'll use one of my teammates who's brilliant. Hey, Jenna, I see that you like to build systems. You like to build things that land and work and serve the wider team. So rather than me coming in and saying, I need you to turn this around in a quick period of time as a prototype, so that we can, you know, move out really quickly, I need to actually come in and say, based on what I understand of what you like to do, can we build a discovery system?
Mm-hmm.
So I actually change my language around what I'm asking for to leverage their superpowers and strengths. And that's been an interesting use of AI for me as a late adopter of a lot of the stuff that's been out there for a couple of years. How are you seeing that show up more analog in the past in terms of good leadership, good management practices, and how are you seeing it change as some of the AI and tooling becomes more like available at our fingertips? We can access language and frameworks that traditionally as leaders, we'd have to go to a course to learn, where now we can kind of get it and play with it.
Yeah. You know,
at the lunch break.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, we've always had thesauruses. So right? Sometimes those can help too, you know, kind of the analog. But it's interesting. I'm not an AI expert. And, you know, I read a lot of the same things that we all do. And, you know, I've certainly used it and things like that. And you hear on one hand that it's going to be the death of all of us and things like that. And on the other hand, that it's going to be the best thing ever. We're going to have to figure out what to do with all our free time kind of thing. And, you know, I think the answer is going to be all over the place, especially in the beginning. So, you know, I think AI can be very helpful. You know, I've seen it be very helpful. I think the one thing is that I don't think we ever want to outsource our thinking, right? And so, that it could be a thought partner, but it shouldn't be leading our thoughts, right? And that's why some of the stuff that I've been reading about it says that, you know, the people that benefit from it most are people that know a lot about what they're talking about. So, you know, if you're a writer and you're a very, very good writer, it might help you find the right word, you know, just like you were saying about how do I explain this to this person? But if you're not a good writer, you don't know what good writing is. And therefore, you're not going to, it's maybe it's better than what you can do, but it's not necessarily teaching you how to do it. So that's a long way of saying, I don't know. So I think we're going to have some good parts about it. We're going to have some not good parts about it. And I think it's just like any new technology. It is a tool and it's going to depend on how we use it. And some people will use it really well and some people will not.
Yeah. Kind of going back to the top of the conversation on like managing yourself. It's really interesting. If you put the AI in the hands of the wrong person, that triggered leader that's angry and impatient, then all of a sudden it becomes a weapon. They just start sending out, well, AI would say that you need to do more of this and you need to do less of that. And they're not starting from where they're at and they're not thinking about why they might feel a certain way and starting to do that kind of discovery and going back to your real conversation with people.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And it depends on what we're starting with, right? If we know this person and here's where they're doing well and here's maybe where they're coming up a little short, I think if we understand where the nuance is, it might be able to help us. But if we just throw it out there and say, what should I tell this person? It's actually not going to help anybody.
Yeah. No, I'm encouraged by that thinking, Margaret, because I have heard the people who are very far right leaning, not politically, but like technology capability. They're way out ahead of where we're at, saying the technology is going to be here in 6 months. A lot of them are saying, well, soon the AI is going to see what's happening in your unstructured data of emails and meeting minutes. And it's going to say, hey, look, Dane and Margaret aren't having an honest conversation around this and this needs to be solved. To me, I can imagine that the data is going to be able to point to things, but going back to your point, it's not going to have the deep domain expertise around what it is that's being discussed in the meeting and what the background relationship is between Dane and Margaret. And even are Dane and Margaret the right two people to solve this problem?
Right. Yeah. And I also think there's another thing too, is that it's, I think, something that we often get mixed up is efficiency and effectiveness. So, right, and this goes with the teams all the time, is people tell me, oh, I really want to have more efficient meetings. And I say, oh, that's easy. Just have one or two bullet points, you know, agenda items and crush them and you're done. But I said to run an effective meeting is a lot harder. And so, and the other thing is that, you know, that we may not be exactly efficient in how we communicate, but we might be effective over a longer period of time.
Oh, time's interesting.
You know, because I think that if you talk to a lot of creative people, they are very comfortable being alone and thinking thoughts on their own, right? They don't get bored. You know, they're the kids that were out on the grass, you know, looking at the clouds and seeing that's a pig and, you know, those kinds of things. And so I think that that is not ineffective, right? Sometimes when you give your brain a break, that is actually that to me, I call this sometimes you have to slow down to speed up. And I think that sometimes us having that water cooler talk or how did your weekend go, right? You know, we might go, oh, well, that's useless, right? Why are we doing that? No, it's not. It's the social glue. It's what allows us to get to know each other. And then as every project most of us have been on, you know, you have ups and downs. And if we don't have that relationship when things are down, we're going to start pointing fingers. Whereas if we know each other, we're much more likely to give each other the benefit of the doubt.
Yes.
Right.
I really appreciate that viewpoint because you're right. I mean, it would be easy to put a team of like-minded, fast-moving people that process out in the open into like an innovation lab and say, go do. But they're going to break things and go on a very different journey than if you had a team that had kind of more the go away, process, play, create, you know, and bring things back. You're going to have a very different set of building blocks from those two different types of work.
Oh, and they'll take completely different paths. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other. They're different. And so depending on what you're trying to do or achieve. And, you know, it just reminds me that right as we came out of the pandemic it was right while we were in the pandemic and I was doing an online executive program. And I remember one guy said, oh, you know, the upside of the pandemic is that we don't have to waste time on that water cooler talk. And I remember saying, you know, hey, be careful what you wish for. Because, you know, that water cooler talk is what helps us get to know one another. And it may not be efficient, but it is absolutely effective. Just like, you know, if we run into each other at the elevator bank and as we're waiting for the elevator, we're talking about what we're doing over the weekend. And I discovered that, you know, oh, gosh, you're a swimmer, too. I'm a swimmer, you know, or something like now we have something in common. And how would we know that if we didn't have these chance encounters? So I think we should try for more of those chance encounters rather than.
I agree. We actually ran a healthy team summit up in Boston back in October. And one of the pieces of work that we identified, we created sort of a team's playground in the lunch break so that people could come and try different tools. There was a New York Times article that had these 36 questions about sort of bringing love into the community or into the workplace. And we took that and adapted it to, I believe, 52 questions for a team. And there were some really cool ground rules, like we're not here to fix each other. Mm-hmm. What we say in this circle stays in the circle. You don't go and share it. And if if it's too emotional, you can pass. But it asks some very interesting human questions, like what's a belief you held strongly as a young person that you no longer hold? Just an example. But people came out with these profound things that they shared with each other. And we just sat there and acknowledged that there may have been some tears, there may have been a laugh. We didn't process it. You know, we live in a society where we're always wanting to process things. We just sat in it and we had acknowledged and appreciated. And we then used that the next day we did a team day. And I found that it just created, going back to your word of social glue, it just created a little bit more like energy, belief, hope within the team as we then started to move into some of the work and the tough, like, oh, we've got to make this decision now and what might we be overlooking? And I saw more contributions from more people in that room. So the activation was super cool.
Oh, I love that. I think that would be such a great way to kick off a team. You know, I do things like that, but not exactly. You know, I use these cards that have questions on them. You know, some of them are, you know, if you could go to a desert island and only take one thing, what would it be?
Yes.
Or, you know, I mean, some of them are not that personal, but they're kind of fun and funny. And some are a little bit more personal. And I have people, you know, exchange cards and answer each other's questions and then move around, et cetera. And it really does make a difference. You hear laughter. And what I always find is that, like, the first couple of interactions are very transactional. We're just going to answer each other's questions and move on. By the end, it's like it could be a 20-minute conversation that they're having. To your point, it's when we get to know people, we discover they're human, right? And they have some of the things in common with me and some things that are not. And, you know, the common things we can talk about, you know, anytime, but the uncommon things might actually make our team better.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great uncommon things make the team better. I think that's so true. It's they're kind of the hidden opportunities. It may not create a task, but it just creates that understanding, awareness, and maybe it brings about that moment where you go to that person to ask for some help that you may not have otherwise asked for.
Exactly. They know. Yeah. Now you know they know something you don't. So now I can ask you. Yes, absolutely.
I love that when Brené Brown was on Stephen Bartlett's Diary of Your CEO podcast, and she was talking about building trust through the putting the marbles in the jar. Did you see that one?
No, but I think I've heard of this.
Yeah. And but it's exactly that. Yeah. As you said, by sharing something with someone, you are actually putting marbles in this jar of trust. It's those small acts, not in the course of the daily work or I'm trusting you with this budget. It's the small acts, the personal acts that help you build that jar of trust.
Absolutely. It's being real, right? Yeah. It's being real. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's also, you know, you're real within a construct, right? You know,
yes.
If you're
there needs to be a container.
There needs to be a container. Yes.
Yeah.
Otherwise it spills out. Exactly. That's
not
good.
That. No, it isn't. Yeah. It isn't. And actually my wife accuses me of that all too often and rightfully so. She'll be like, and my kids do, by the way, they're like, how come whenever we're out, you just bounce into people and start sharing stuff with them and getting energized and that and the other. And I get energy of it, but because there's no container, it kind of spreads me out a bit too thin at times.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about.
We've got to be careful there. Trying to turn everything into something.
You know what? I love that story for so many reasons, but one of them is that your kids tell you this too.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, our kids can zero right in on, you know, what you need to think about. They see it very, very clearly.
Oh, yeah. And they see the trade-off, which often we don't as leaders. Mm-hmm. If my kid's like, hey, we were just walking by that security guard and you started talking to him about how his day was and how you loved his hat and what's the name of his dog. And you forgot that you were meant to be taking me down to the park to practice throwing the ball. Like, they call you out right there.
They do. But you know what's so great about it, too, is that your kids will remember the good part. They will
remember the good
part of that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they'll, it is funny. And you know, that's part of understanding ourselves is, you know, you probably got that from somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. How you, maybe it was somebody that you knew, or it was the opposite, right? Somebody didn't want to know anybody. And so you thought, oh, I'm curious. I do.
Interesting.
So, and so we pick up these things. Your kids will surprise you when you get older, all the things that you tell them that you think, you know, oh, they're not listening. Oh, wait until they get into their 20s and 30s. You'll start to see it come out.
Yeah. Yeah, it is fascinating. I wonder if that's a part of the future that we're going to need our coaches to kind of come and do a group session with our family. Tell us how Dane really acts as a CEO at home.
That's right. That's right. Sometimes that would not be a good thing for people to come and ask that question.
I know. Oh, that's neat. So as you think to the future, Margaret, and this desire for people to work together and these tools and frameworks and stories that they can leverage, where do you think the real shifts are going to happen? Do you think it is starting with leaders of larger teams? Do you think every team member, even if they're not in charge of a large span of team members, can be using some of these tools to manage up and out? How does it kind of
influence? I do. I believe that the only thing, first of all, you have to understand yourself and then manage yourself. Both of those are hard, but managing yourself is harder. But if you start with understanding yourself, then you know which parts you want to manage better or differently. And so I think that once we understand and manage ourselves, we're more grounded, and therefore we are less what's the word I want to say? We're less buffeted by every single wind that goes by, and we're not shaken to our core the way perhaps maybe we were before. And so that gives us a power, right? That gives we have power over ourselves. That doesn't mean we don't feel grief or we don't feel upset if somebody yells at us or these kinds of things, but we can manage it a lot better. And I think that people like to work with people like that.
And 100%.
Right. And then they want to emulate some of those things. And so that's kind of how it works. But it starts with us because we can't change anyone else. It's hard enough to change us ourselves. Right. But forget that. We got to start with ourselves. And really, it is a way of creating a movement is by starting with yourself and showing the results that can be and developing other people. You know, I have a friend who is a very good people manager, really, really good, and just loves doing it. And she told me, this was years ago, she said, you know, people oftentimes will come, she worked in a big organization, they know that I'm a really good people manager, and they come and they pluck people from, you know, my part of the organization. And I said, oh my gosh, I said, you spend all this time and effort with these people. Doesn't that kind of make you mad, you know, that they do this? And she laughed at me and she said, oh, you are looking at this all wrong. And she said, you know, I get people to where they're not going to grow anymore under me. So then I help them find something else. And she said, you know, I can get anything done. She said, I have friends all over the place. And she said, in the organization, I pick up the phone and I call them, done, right? If it's outside of the organization, done. And I thought, oh, I love that. She actually had such a great framing for that. And to me, that is that ripple effect, is we start with this and it grows beyond.
Yeah. I love the ripple effect. I love that we're ending there because it's so aligned with my philosophy, and I think the philosophy of a lot of leaders today, which is if we can lead well in our businesses, then that flows back not only into our business ecosystem, customers, suppliers, but also into the local community. People go home happier as employees. They're more going to your point about being grounded. They're more resilient. They're able to show up better for various community activities, and that's really encouraging.
It is. And we need more of that.
A lot more. Yeah. Well, it's been a great conversation. I love how you were sharing that a lot of these things come from those early bad management experiences that it allows us to understand that we need to change and seek out that wisdom. I love the wisdom over self. I think that's so powerful, and it's so accessible to everyone, no matter what their station is. And as we came through the best team, worst team dynamic, I love the way that you shared that it comes back to real conversations, people that, you know, are there to challenge us to grow and give you the benefit of doubt. It's very human. And that's a big theme right now. And touching on, as we got into AI, the discussion around efficiency versus effectiveness, again, more human coming forwards by you know, the effectiveness isn't always the fastest path to something.
Yes.
And it can happen over time. Really appreciating that the fact that you shine a light on that and the social glue that comes with some of our human interactions along the way. And I will send you some of our leader lounge cards. I'll make sure we do that.
They may end up in my card pack, and I'll mention that. Yeah.
Love to see that. But yeah, wonderful conversation. Love the ripple effect. And for any of our listeners who want to find Manage Yourself to Lead Others or any of your coursework or keynote speaking, how do they best find your materials?
Yeah, so the best place to find me is one of two places. One is on LinkedIn. I'm Margaret C. Andrews on LinkedIn, and my website, which is margaretandrews.com. So pretty easy to find me. Yeah.
Well, this has been a blast, Margaret. Thanks for bringing so much good energy and wisdom to the table.
Thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on The Future of Teamwork.